introduction, but I'll give it one anyway. It's Dave Douglas, who was a miner for 40 years or more. He was a very active member of the National Union of Mine Workers, been a rank and file activist, and then a branch official in the Hatfield Main Colliery. He was one of the leading figures in the 1984-85 miners' strike. And he's also the author of a trilogy of works about his life and political and union activities. It's a trilogy. The second one, which he's holding in his hand now, is The Wheel's Still in Spin, which focuses on the 70s. And the other ones, Steve is holding up at the back. Jordan's one is the first one. And the third one that I just finished reading this summer is about the focuses not only on the 1984-85 miners' strike, but what happened afterwards. The struggles that the miners actually continued. Everyone thinks the NUM was completely depleted by 84-85. It wasn't the case at all, and that really documents the continuing struggles in the pits right the way through into the 90s. But Dave's come to speak to us today about the early 70s in particular, and he's going to speak for half an hour, Dave.
Okay. I just want to read from the introduction to that to this book. The decade and a half between the end of the 60s and the rise of Margaret Thatcher witnessed a massive and global revolutionary upsurge. In part, this was symbolised by the almost impossible heroic struggle of the Vietnamese people against the naked imperialism of the USA. Off the shore of the mass empire of capital, little defiant Cuba sat within spitting distance. Nationalist struggles and class struggles rocked the world. Liberation and resistance movements joined with the blown winds of change. Within the belly of the US beast, the civil rights movement and the armed wings of class and racial justice were emerging to challenge the status quo in their own backyard. In Europe, the urban guerrilla lived not in the evergreen but among the concrete jungles of downtown cities and finance capitals as the Red Army faction, the Red Brigades, the 1st of May Group and the Angry Brigade formed pockets of resistance to bring the rebellion home. In Ireland, the Provisional IRA was beginning its long war against the British state, winning increasing authority among the oppressed, occupied population of Ulster, Scotland, of occupied Ulster. In Britain, the biggest industrial challenge since the 20s was afoot as unions and wildcats unleashed the greatest number of strike days since the general strike. Within the unions and despite the unions, the rank and file sought to stamp its control on work and unions and communities. The National Union of Mine Workers, which someone was to call the shock troops of the TUC, presided over the rise of the flying picket and the mass secondary action, which would take a government by the balls. For a time it looked like the Labour movement would take the whole system by the throat. Dockers, building workers struck and fought toe-to-toe against scabs and police. Rent strikes, occupations, work-ins and mass demonstrations posed old ideologies and commonwealth solutions to corporation solidarity. All of these movements and tendencies and ideologies overlapped, interbred and formed a loose but comprehensive movement. The wheel was surely in spin and there was no telling who it was naming. This was a time when the world was up for grabs. The earth resounded to the world revolutionary impulse. The genie were free from the bottle and the music was up loud. From where we all stand now, that distant period seems dim and becomes dimmer with every new law and every new successive government brick that they place on the wall. Soon the hope nobody will remember how close we came to finishing with the whole scumbag system. And I think that sets really a scene that we aren't just talking about a situation that developed in Britain. It was very much a part of a global upsurge that was happening, had happened since the 60s right the way through, and inspired and re-inspired each other across continents and across the world. For us, for young miners as we were at that particular time, 1969, there had been no strikes in the coal industry, no national strikes in the coal industry since 1926, since the miners were totally smashed, and the we had a decade of the blacklist and really where the bosses had the whip hand. And we, with the incoming Wilson government, of course, was talking about the white hot heat of modern technology, how coal was an anachronism, nobody needed miners, it would be pointless to for miners to go on strike to try and improve the condition, what would be the point? Nobody wanted coal. And really, that started to wear thin by 1969, impelled by lots of these movements that were happening around the world, and the kind of revolutionism of the 60s, which inspired young miners. They weren't just students as part of that thing, as popularly ascribed to the 60s. Young workers were very much a part of that whole revolutionary upsurge in testing the parameters of all experiences. It was something we were involved in as well. We decided that we had enough of that. And if the pits were going to stay open one day longer, then we wanted paying for to work in them. So, quite unofficially, the Derbyshire area of the union called a national demonstration in London. And it was the first time that miners had got together nationwide, really, since about 1911. And we all flooded into London. And I remember the shocked railway porters and taxi drivers in London who thought there were no miners in Britain. They actually thought we'd already all gone because we'd been that quiet. In fact, there were 300,000 coal miners in that particular period. We launched an unofficial strike action right across the coal fields, particularly with Yorkshire and Scotland and Wales coming out on strike against the union leadership, demanding the reduction in surface hours for surface workers who'd been neglected over the years. Nationalisation in 1947 had promised that the increases in hours that we'd had inflicted on us in 1926 would be removed, and it hadn't been removed. Consequently, the surface workers were working excessive hours. So this strike was primarily aimed at the reduction of surface hours. And really, the first thing that happened is we couldn't believe it when within weeks and within days, industry started to close down. And it demonstrated to us that they actually needed coal. Contrary to Wilson's image of the white hot heat of modern technology, Wilson had said, you know, we had to get miners out of these holes in the ground, out of these cramped little spaces with dripping water, and bring them into nice, clean factories, and energy would be supplied by nuclear power, which was quite benign, because Wilson thought nuclear power grew on trees. Like most people did, he didn't realise the uranium miners who dug the uranium out were working in conditions 100 times worse than we were digging coal out. He thought it was just something you plugged in and it'd come on. So it was a demonstration to us that actually we had power. And within, although the wage negotiations which were going on at the time were actually about wages, and not about surface hours, they actually granted us the full wage claim, which is something that had never ever happened to us in our history. And on the side, they got the strike over by agreeing unofficially that all the surface workers would have their hours reduced to 8 hours, which they did. So it demonstrated to us that militancy worked. And we were now posing a challenge to the existing union leadership, which had sat and collaborated with the coal board. In fact, they were quite indistinguishable. The union side on the coal board were quite indistinguishable from the directors of the coal board in their paternalism and their outlook that they would cooperate with whatever government was in office, that they would collaborate with whatever their energy policy was. Wilson, of course, closed more coal mines down than Margaret Thatcher did. Without a spark of bloody resistance, because it was taken as, you know, this was an inevitable thing as we moved into the future. It lit a bonfire, and the next year, 1970, then again the Doncaster area went on strike again in support of a wage claim, and we had a national ballot on that, but at that particular time the rule was that we needed two-thirds majority to get an official strike action. A two-thirds majority was almost impossible to achieve. We actually achieved a majority of 55%, which wasn't enough, so there was no strike action, or there wasn't supposed to be. But we went on strike anyway, regardless of what the rules said. And we picketed out coal fields, which became a trend. We did it in 1969. We went from pit to pit, area to area, and brought coal field out, and we did it the same in 1970. And we had an unofficial strike for a month, in 1970, in defiance of the Coal Board, the government, and the union. It set a trend for challenges to the rules and challenges to the area and national leadership in the union. Wilson's income policy at the time set the scene for the later thing that we've seen on the film there with the Tories. He set the scene about anti-union legislation, wage restraint, incomes policy, and all the rest of it. And the resistance, we had a one-day national strike, unofficial national strike, with something like 100,000 workers went on strike against Wilson. Wilson actually was later turned out of office because this wasn't the government that people had voted for. The first government of Wilson, of course, had a slender majority and was hamstrung. But by the time of the second election, where he achieved a massive majority, he came to office on the promise of the most widespread social transformation and progress since the Attlee government. In fact, it was so challenging a program that the state was so terrified that they actually organised a coup against the Wilson government. Now, if that sounds fanciful, it's well documented that an assortment of bankers, press owners and military heads came to Lord Mountbatten and asked Lord Mountbatten if he would head up a provisional government with the approval of the Queen. Now, they'd been working night and day to undermine the authority of the Wilson government, what with the strikes of capital and refusals of investment and shifting money away to try and cripple them, while the press had hammered away night and day black propaganda against aimed at Wilson and the Wilson government. But here was a military coup which was being prepared against the government, the elected government. Now, we on our side were preparing to meet that challenge, and as I say, we stand a long way from that now, but where we stood then was we were prepared militarily to meet the challenge of that coup, and I suppose ostensibly it would have been in defence of the elected government, but actually it would have been to progress and implement that that programme of taking over the means of production, distribution and exchange. And we were, both sides were that far away when Wilson, of course, resigned. Now, the bullet was served not by the organisers of the coup, but by the electors who decided they didn't want this government. This government was not going to implement the programme, and abstained. The Tories didn't get any bigger a vote, but they got elected because the Labour voters stayed at home. They organised a boycott, and in the process probably saved Wilson's life, if not his political life, maybe his physical life. And it allowed Ted Heath to come to power. It must be said, some of the preparations for this coup, by the way, just by the way, you've seen a little bit of it there on the telly on the programme there with the police blockades and stuff like that. They organised massive military manoeuvres, taking over Heathrow Airport, if you remember at the time. Taking over Heathrow Airport, taking over key centres of government administration without telling the government. Wilson and the cabinet had no idea why the tanks were on the streets and why these manoeuvres were being, this was done quite unilaterally from an elected government. Now, people have forgotten.
How did that happen? Sorry. How did that happen?
The army decided it would demonstrate, ostensibly on the back of the IRA upsurge, that it would do these things. But the fact that it did it without any permission or consultation with the government demonstrated that another card was being played here, and Wilson was having his card marked and told, you step out of line and we can take over this whole shebang. And we were quite conscious of that as a movement, as a rise in trade union movement, that as to what we were up against and who was on the other side. And I mean, you'd really have to look at some of the statements that people like Brigadier Kitson, the counterinsurgency team that he led, where what they were looking at, how they seen the left very definitely and the workers' movement very definitely as being opponents of the state per se. Heath came to office, I think probably convincing himself that there was a mass anti-trade union backlash taking place here. In fact, it wasn't true at all. As I say, he came to office because of an abstention of Labour voters. But it took him into... he carried on immediately from the Wilson government to carry on with its income policy. And at the same time, as if he wasn't taking on enough fronts, he brought in what he called the Fair Rent Act. And the Fair Rent Act demanded that councils, because most people lived in council houses in those days, raise the level of council rents to the fair rent. Not only that, but they then give an instruction or an enabling act to allow private landlords, such as the Code Board, for example. The Code Board had 1 million tenants. To raise its rents. So across the country, you've got an immediate unified effect of council tenants and private tenants, and the launch of mass rent strikes. Rent strikes at least of the proportion that you had in the poll tax refusals. People refused to pay. And we organised mass tenants associations with street committees. Every street had a representative. Every representative met in community organisation. We seen these directly as sort of democratic workers' councils that would take the place of the system should it fall, that would take over and become the administration of an area. That's the way we politically consciously thought about it. Your average tenant, of course, didn't perhaps see it that way at that time. But here you had another iron in the fire, and you had millions and millions and millions of people refusing to pay the rents. And at the same time, we demanded of Labour-controlled councils that they didn't implement the Fair Rents Act and refused to take part. Now, most of them buckled when they were personally surcharged, except, of course, Clay Cross Council. And the Clay Cross councils were debarred from holding office and had their goods seized and all the rest of it. But it was another wing to that developing 70s movement that was taking place at the time. When the miners came into the first conflict in 1972, where we had been blocked by incomes policy, the Coal Board simply said, well, you know, we would like to pay more wages, but the government wouldn't allow us. So it immediately became a challenge to the government. We held a national ballot, which we did achieve a 55%. We changed the rules by then. Vote, which was only just over the margin, and the strike took place. Once the strike started, I don't think that there had been any strike in Britain since the 20s of that level of proportion of in terms of the mobilisation of mass picketing. Mass picketing came into its own during that period. We had pickets on the Thames in boats. We picketed tankers on the river. We picketed tankers at sea. You know, the whole place was closed down, lock, stock and barrel. And by and large, workers supported the picket and refused to cross picket lines. We had one or two hemorrhages. Of course, Saltley became the most famous one. A coke depot down in Birmingham that continued to leak coal through, and we had more and more pickets going down there and more cops pouring in there, and it became a real battle until the Birmingham engineers took a vote that they weren't going to tolerate for this anymore. 80,000 Birmingham engineers stopped work, and 40,000 of them marched with flags flying and banners flying to the gates of Saltley and shut Saltley down. Arthur Scargill became famous because he happened to be there with a camera crew from from Yorkshire that just happened to be around, and it made his career. And Arthur was credited with having organised Saltley. As a matter of fact, probably Frank Watters of the Communist Party, who had great influence with the shop stewards movement in Birmingham, probably had more to do with the actual success of that particular operation. But on the back of of Saltley Gate, we'd won. Just prior to Saltley, of course, a man from my picket, who was a comrade of mine, Freddie Matthews, had been killed picketing at Scunthorpe at Neap House Wharf, when a scab driver said, if anybody got in the way, he'd run them over. And right enough, he did run them over and killed him. And after that particular time, within 2 days, 13 unarmed people were shot down in Derry on the demonstration. Now, you didn't have to be a genius or a wild-eyed political person to make the connection between what was happening on the streets of Ulster and what was happening here with people being run down and the shenanigans in the wings that the state had in line for us. And people were making the connection, much to the terror, I think, of the government at the time. And again, as I say, what you can't do is to take away the fact what was happening day by day in the world, in places like Vietnam and in America itself. This was a part of a political identification with a class movement. This wasn't just some bread and butter issue. This wasn't just about improving your wages and conditions, although many workers did do that. Many, many other workers also drew the conclusion that there was a political conclusion to draw from this. Just cutting to the chase at the end, of course, by the time we get to the 1974... having won everything that we demanded in 1972, by the time we got to 1974, most of those gains had been eroded away. And we went again to an overtime. But this time, we got an 89% national ballot result in areas like Scotland, Yorkshire, Wales, Kent, nearly 100%. Nigh enough 100% of the miners voted in favour of that. By that time, the TUC itself had decided that it would support the miners through hell and high water, and we had total solidarity. I went down to that, I was picketing down at that wharf where my comrade had been killed 2 years earlier, and didn't see a lorry. Like six of us sat in a shed watching the boats go by. There weren't any lorries. The whole of Labour shut down lock, stock and barrel across the country, and people were itching to get into the action. Workers bending over backwards. I mean, I remember at Cowley, the Cowley car workers, the factory was heated by coke, asked me to put pickets on the pile of coke so the factory wouldn't be heated, so all the Cowley car workers could come out alongside us, and we like declined to pick at the pile of coke, but we did stop them bringing any new coke in. So they then started to burn the coke as if it was the Titanic going across the Atlantic to make sure they get rid of it, just to try and get in on the action. Heath had brought in the 3-day week and stuff like that, but most workers had a 5-day week agreement. So it just meant you got 5 days' wages for 3 days' work. So, you know, if the idea was to try and sicken the miners, the workers from the miners, it didn't work. And then he called his fifth state of emergency within a week of the call of the strike to declare, you know, how the country was going to rack and ruin, and then declare call a general election around the slogan, "Who Rules Britain?" I mean, he was most ill-advised. He had only just been elected. The things that we were demanding had already been conceded ideologically by his own inquiry, Wilberforce inquiry into the wage claim 2 years earlier. And I think he believed his own propaganda that there'd be a massive swell of public opinion against the unions and against the winter of discontent and all, well, against the rise of tide of the wildcats, etc. And of course, when he went to the country, "Who Rules Britain?" People said, "Well, not you anyway," and he went. Just prior to that time, Joe Gormley, the president of the miners' union, had asked for us to call off the strike to show what good constitutionalists we were, and would we go back to work while the general election was held. And of course, he was told the bollocks in no uncertain terms that the miners would be on strike, whoever was elected, Tory or Labour, and we wanted justice, whoever was elected. The only deal we were prepared to make was a wage deal, and the men, to their credit, stayed on strike and stayed on the picket line right through until the incoming government was forced to concede 99% of the wage claim that the miners put forward. Just in as a final sentence, we didn't get away with it, of course. Both the Tories and Labour went away and set up think tanks as to how to take on a future miners' strike and break the power of the miners' union, which was seen as the stormtroops of the TUC. So, you know, the war wasn't over. But the memorable thing about the 70s was people had the will to fight, had the class consciousness to fight, And really the rest follows from that. You don't need union leaders to tell you to go on strike when there's an injustice. Workers should have the ability to organise themselves, work off the job. The way in which the BA dispute was handled, for example, I don't mean the cabin crew, I mean the Gate Gourmet dispute, pose an absolute contrast to the way that we've seen with the dockers there, where we had a de facto general strike developing in Britain. The miners were ready to come out in support of the dockers at that time. Had we had the same kind of initiative in support of the Gate Gourmet workers, we might well have changed the whole course of society.
Yeah,